This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to the main topic
in the margin of a book.
David Barron's new book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World, is about the history and the players involved in the total solar eclipse of 1878. Total solar eclipses are not rare. They take place at some point on Earth about every 18 months. The problem is that sometimes those locations are remote and difficult to reach. The eclipse of 1878 stretched from Montana down to Texas. Set in the wild frontier, this particular eclipse was remarkable because of the lengths taken by our young nation to prove its scientific worth. And with the much-anticipated total solar eclipse reaching coast to coast on August 21st, Barron's look back at our nation's scientific trajectory is especially timely. I recently met with David Barron at the KCUR studios in Kansas City. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Now, American Eclipse focuses on a specific total solar eclipse. But just to set this up, what are the different types of eclipses? Or is it called, is it eclipses? How do you say it?
Eclipses. Yeah. So, there are solar eclipses and there are lunar eclipses. So a lunar eclipse, an eclipse of the moon, occurs at night when the moon passes in the shadow of the Earth. So sometimes it's called the blood moon. So the full moon passes into the Earth's shadow, and it actually doesn't go away, but it turns a very deep red color. And that's really interesting, and it's not that rare. You might see it every few years where you are. It can be quite beautiful. A solar eclipse occurs when the moon is on the other side of the Earth, when the moon is between the Earth and the sun, and the moon blocks at least part of the sun. And a partial solar eclipse is not that rare. If you use special glasses with really dark lenses, eclipse glasses, you can look at it because otherwise you'll ruin your vision, and you'll see that it looks like a chunk of the sun is missing, or it might even look like the sun is a crescent, and that's very interesting. A total solar eclipse, however, is a far rarer and completely different type of experience. A total solar eclipse occurs when the moon completely blocks the face of the sun. Any given point on Earth experiences a total solar eclipse about once every 400 years, and the experience is just otherworldly because it goes dark in the middle of the day. And during a total eclipse, you actually can look at the sun with the naked eye, and you'll see the sun's outer atmosphere, which is just the most glorious sight in the heavens.
And it happens once every 400 years?
In any given point on Earth, okay, we'll see a total eclipse about once every 400 years. However, somewhere on Earth, there's a total eclipse about every 18 months. However, you'll need to travel to see it. A total eclipse can only be seen in a narrow path called the Path of Totality. It's usually about 100 miles wide, and it'll snake across the globe. But most of the globe is water, so most of the path is over water, usually. Sometimes the path will go over Antarctica or the middle of Africa. A total eclipse that is easily accessible might occur every 4 or 5 years. The last total eclipse to pass over any part of the continental United States was 38 years ago. The one that's coming up on August 21st of this year is a very big deal. It'll be the first, in fact, in 99 years to cross the country coast to coast.
Now, your book focuses on the total solar eclipse of 1878 and the various players and expeditions to study it. And it was best seen in places like Colorado and Wyoming. So let's talk about some of the players involved. And one, if it can be considered a player, was Congress, because Europe had been laughing at us. And the French Academy and the Royal Observatory at London, they were sending expeditions over, yet Congress wouldn't approve funding. And a Minnesota senator, is he the one who said that there was too much moonshine in it? I mean, what was the deal with Congress not wanting to fund this?
Right. Well, you raise some really good points. So just to give a little bit of context, back in the 1800s, total solar eclipses were very important to science. There were certain studies astronomers could do only during a total solar eclipse, which, of course, occurs somewhere on Earth, usually about once every 18 months, but in some very specific zone. So these expeditions would be sent off to go to the Path of Totality and conduct studies. 1878, the Path of Totality of that eclipse crossed America's Wild West. It went from Montana Territory down to Texas. And Americans scientists wanted to go study it, not only because they wanted to do some research on the sun, but also because this was America's chance to show Europe that we were a maturing intellectual country. We were just barely 100 years old. Europe looked down their noses at us as an industrial power, but frankly not a very smart, not a very intelligent country. But there was a small band of American scientists who wanted to show and to use this eclipse to show that we could do science. So they asked Congress for a small appropriation to fund some government expeditions out to the West. And at first, Congress wouldn't do it. In the end, Congress did appropriate $8,000, which even back then was not a heck of a lot of money. It's a lot more than it is today. But it took a lot of work to convince the politicians that this was worth funding. And that says something about, you know, the government's attitude toward science in that era. We really hadn't yet kind of decided as a nation that science was something that was worth our collective effort. And that's one of the main points I make in my book, is that this eclipse in 1878 was one of several kind of defining moments that helped inspire America to come together around science and become what we are today, which is the global superpower in scientific research.
Now, I want to talk about some of the specific players and what they were hoping to study when they got to the eclipse. Simon Newcomb, you wrote that he was tasked with charting the course, calculating the duration, and alerting the public about the 1878 eclipse. Talk to me a little bit about him.
Simon Newcomb is a really interesting guy, and I'm embarrassed to say I had not heard of him before I started writing the book. But back in that era, back in the late 1800s, he was a real public, prominent intellectual in America. He was an astronomer, but he was more than that. He also wrote about economics. He was a professor, but his main job was an astronomer, and he headed something called the Nautical Almanac Office, which was part of the Navy. Obviously, navigation at that time was done by astronomy, by sighting on the stars and the planets. And so the Navy published something called the Nautical Almanac, which was essentially a thick book that gave you day by day where the various planets would be seen in the heavens, where the moon would be. And so the Nautical Almanac Office calculated the path of the eclipse. And so Simon Newcomb was the guy who basically was in charge of calculating where the eclipse would go and alerting the public. And so he was one of those folks who, in fact, was really pushing Congress to fund some expeditions out to the West.
Now, is that organization that you mentioned, was that the old boys club where they would play chess? And is that the one?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, the Nautical Almanac Office, which originally was housed in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right by Harvard University, it later moved to Washington. It was, I mean, you know, it was kind of where the geeks hung out. These were the folks who enjoyed calculating the orbits of the planets. And when I say calculating, calculating by hand, the job title of these folks was computer. Computer, before it was an electronic device, a computer was a person. It was a job. And so the Nautical Almanac Office hired these young, in every case but one, men to work as computers.
Okay, so James Craig Watson, he was a planet and asteroid discoverer. He was the nemesis of Christian Heinrich Friedrich Peters. And of those two, even though they were battling to find the minor planets, only Watson journeyed west, and he was looking for the planet Vulcan.
Yes. So asteroids back then, asteroids which, of course, are chunks of rock floating in space circling the sun, back in that era, very few asteroids had yet been found, and they were called planets. They were called minor planets, and finding them was a big deal. James Craig Watson, who taught astronomy at the University of Michigan, his claim to fame was he had found more asteroids than just about anyone on Earth. His main rival at that time was C.H.F. Peters, who was another American, although he was born in Europe. And they were battling it out quite publicly for who was going to be number one in finding asteroids, which were called planets. James Craig Watson, for the eclipse of 1878, he had his sight set on an even bigger fish. He wasn't just going to find another asteroid. He was going to find a planet, and the planet was called Vulcan. And Vulcan was what you might call a hypothetical planet that astronomers believed had to exist between Mercury and the Sun, because Mercury's orbit didn't quite make sense based on Newtonian mechanics. And the only way astronomers could explain this was to imagine, well, there's got to be a planet between Mercury and the Sun, and it's tugging on Mercury and distorting its orbit. So this planet was given the name Vulcan. No one had ever reliably seen it, but that wasn't really a surprise because it's so close to the Sun, it's never going to be in the sky at night, and you can't see it in the daytime because it's lost in the Sun's glare. But during a total solar eclipse, when the moon very briefly for 2 or 3 minutes blocks the face of the sun, it would enable you to look right around the sun and see if there's some shining point of light that's not on your star chart. So James Craig Watson in 1878 heads out to Wyoming with the very clear intent that he was going to find Vulcan, and that would just launch him into even greater fame.
And he was convinced he saw it.
Yes. The big headline, frankly, out of the eclipse of 1878 was Vulcan was found, and it was found by an American, and America was very proud. You can probably guess that James Craig Watson, we know, was wrong, but he could not accept that he was wrong. He had a huge ego, and even as it became clearer and clearer that he probably got it wrong, he couldn't accept it, and he actually was so determined to prove that he'd been right. He had this crazy scheme for re-finding Vulcan without an eclipse, and he quite literally worked himself to death 2 years later.
He had tapped somebody's shoulder to try to get them to verify, and the guy wouldn't look away from what he was searching for.
Yeah, and in fact, the person whose shoulder he tapped was Simon Newcomb.
Oh, okay.
So the two of them were together in Wyoming. But remember, the total eclipse lasted less than 3 minutes.
Right.
So they had so much to do in such a brief time. And by the time Watson was able to get Newcomb's attention, the eclipse was over.
And the person who finally proved that Vulcan does not exist was Einstein.
Right. Yeah, the Vulcan story is a really interesting story. And it begins prior to 1878, and it doesn't really end until 1919. And the person who solved the mystery of Mercury's orbit was Albert Einstein. And the reason that Mercury's orbit didn't quite fit Newtonian mechanics is because Newtonian mechanics isn't quite right. It took Albert Einstein to figure out that around really heavy, dense objects like the sun, gravity distorts basically the fabric of space, and that changes the way things move. And that's called general relativity. And so Einstein's theory of general relativity is what explained Mercury's orbit without the need to imagine a planet called Vulcan. And it actually was at another total eclipse in 1919 that Einstein was proven to be right, because when general relativity was first proposed, it was seemed kind of preposterous. And a lot of physicists didn't think that Einstein was right. But one of the key tests was during a total eclipse in 1919, some British astronomers looked at stars that were just on either side of the eclipsed sun to see if they could measure the way the sun's gravity bent starlight and to see if that bending matched with general relativity. And sure enough, it seemed to, and that's usually looked on as the confirmation that Einstein was right. And once we knew Einstein was right, there was no need for Vulcan, and Vulcan sort of vanished in a puff of smoke.
What do you think of the scientists who today think that there's another planet out there, that super Earth, that's supposed to be like 10 times the size of Earth? What do you make of that?
Well, I can't speak to that specifically, but it's the same phenomenon and it's the same with other things in space, like dark matter. We don't know what it is, but why do we imagine that it's there? Because we see the effects of it. Because in order for our understanding of the universe to make sense, we have to invent something called dark matter or a planet X or whatever, even though no one's seen it, and then we look for it. However, we have to remember it may be that there is no dark matter or there is no planet X. It's our formulas that are wrong. But that's how science works. You know, you come up with a way of explaining the universe through math, and then it works pretty well, but then you find there's a problem. And so you then look to see is your math right and your understanding of the universe is wrong, and you got to find something that's out there, or maybe it's your math that's wrong. And that's the way we learn about how things work.
So another player was Mariah Mitchell, and she was a professor at Vassar. She took an expedition of only women. What was Mariah looking for?
I just love Mariah Mitchell. So I mentioned a short time ago that the Nautical Almanacs hired computers and in every case but one, they were men, she was the exception. Mariah Mitchell came to fame in 1847 when she was living on Nantucket. She was a librarian by day, but at night, she was an astronomer. She was just doing astronomy on her own. And she discovered a comet. And for that, she received a gold medal from the King of Denmark. The comet was known as Miss Mitchell's Comet. And she became quite a celebrity. By 1878, she was teaching astronomy at Vassar College. And she also had worked for a while as a computer at the Nautical Almanac Office. But by 1878, she was teaching at Vassar. And, you know, as you can imagine, this was a time when it was extremely hard to be a female scientist, to find a job, to be educated in the sciences, and then to find a paying job was almost unheard of. Her job was to teach the next generation, and she was a staunch advocate for women in science and women's higher education at a time when societal attitudes were that basically women couldn't do science, women shouldn't do science, women shouldn't be highly educated. It wasn't good for them. There was a book that came out that said it was bad for their health. So in this context, in 1878, when all of these men were assembling these eclipse expeditions to the West and even receiving government support from that grand $8,000 that the Congress had appropriated for these expeditions, Mariah Mitchell was excluded. But she wouldn't accept it. She decided she would put together her own eclipse expedition. It was all women, and they went out to Colorado to the Wild West. And it was, you know, they were there to do science, but it was more than that. It really was kind of political theater, an effort to show the public that women could be smart and educated and do science. And she got a lot of praise. I think she, you know, it's not like she suddenly flung open the doors of science to women, but she did open it a crack. And it was really interesting at that time to see what people were saying just about how inspired they were by what she did.
What was her time frame versus like Caroline Herschel?
Well, Caroline Herschel was quite a bit earlier. Mm-hmm. So Caroline Herschel, whose brother was William Herschel, the two of them were great astronomers. Mariah Mitchell, in fact, she really admired the Herschels, and particularly Caroline. In 1878, when she was out in Denver for the eclipse right afterwards, she actually gave a public lecture about Caroline Herschel. And the proceeds went to fund an organization that was promoting women's suffrage, getting women the vote in Colorado. So she was out there in the Wild West educating about science and trying to help women's rights.
Now, finally, Edison. He wasn't an academic, and he was mocked by other scientists early in his career. It almost seemed like he kept getting in his own way. You know, he would spout off about how he had this great discovery. So he was proclaiming how this tessimeter was going to measure the microtemperature coming off the sun. It hadn't even worked yet. And he was traveling out there with this handheld tessimeter, and he had 3.5 minutes to get it to work. Talk to me a little bit about Edison.
Yeah, I had so much fun learning about Edison, you know, age 31, going out west right after he'd invented the phonograph. He'd become a global celebrity. He goes out west to study the total solar eclipse. And he invents this device called the tessimeter, which today we would call an infrared detector. It basically was an incredibly, he claimed, sensitive measurer of heat that could detect changes in temperature as small as 1/1,000,000th of a degree Fahrenheit. And he was going to use it to study the solar corona, what today we know is the sun's outer atmosphere. Back then they didn't know what it was, but it could only be seen during a total eclipse, this weird, beautiful aura around the sun. And it wasn't clear if it just gave off light or also gave off heat, and that's what he was going to see. But Edison, Edison's just such a great character. He was a brilliant inventor. He was quirky. He thought outside the box. And he was just amazing at public relations, and that was part of his success. He got the newspapers on his side. He kind of scared off other inventors and got money to help fund his own inventions by, frankly, lying a little bit about how far he'd gotten in his research. And that was true of the tessimeter. He was talking about it. Even when he just dreamed up the idea, before he even built it, he was saying that he was going to have this device that could measure temperature like nothing before. And it was exactly the same way he acted with the light bulb. when Edison returned from Wyoming, the very next day he started work on the light bulb. And within a few weeks, he announced to the press that he had solved the problem of electric lighting, which is incandescent lighting, which was something others had been working on for quite some time. He hadn't figured it out, but the newspapers were just all over Edison, and the money came pouring in for him to do the research. And then he had to prove, actually, that he could do it, which he didn't know how to do it. In fact, some of the people who knew Edison said that he intentionally did this. He would paint himself into a corner where he had better figure this out because he told people he could do it. And lucky for him and lucky for us, it took him a while, but he did figure out how to make a commercially viable incandescent light bulb. But anyway, in 1878, Edison, at this key point in his life, was kind of playing not just as an inventor, but a scientist. And actually what he learned in the West in terms of talking to other scientists who were encouraging him to take up the challenge of electric lighting, and what he learned in the West about public relations really were key to his success with the light bulb.
Now, you have witnessed 5 total eclipses. Where have they been?
My first was in Aruba in 1998, and then the next year in 1999, I was in Munich. And then I kind of took a break because, frankly, chasing eclipses is expensive and I had other priorities for my life. But then I decided about a while later that I just find it such an emotionally moving experience that I wanted to make it a priority. So I picked it up again. In 2012, I went to Queensland, Australia. 2015, I was in the Faroe Islands in the North Atlantic. And then last year, I went to Indonesia to see one. So this August in the United States, this will be my 6th total eclipse.
And you mentioned that it's an emotional experience. What are some of the examples that people might experience if they see one?
People cry, people scream, people jump up and down. I mean, it depends on the individual, but it can be an extremely emotional experience. You just feel, I am not a traditionally religious person, but I can only describe it as a religious experience. It's like seeing God. To look up in the sky and see this absolutely foreign and beautiful thing in the heavens, which is the sun's outer atmosphere, the solar corona, that is this heavenly crown that shimmers and it has a shape to it. Pictures don't convey what it's really like. It's not just like a ring around the sun. It's like it's made out of strands of silk. And you have a sense of the depth of space. I mean, imagine, you know, I'm sure you've seen pictures of the Grand Canyon and perhaps you've been to the Grand Canyon. And there's an enormous difference between seeing a picture and seeing the real thing, right? You walk up to the edge of the Grand Canyon and you're overwhelmed with this sense of enormity and the space between you and the other rim and the space looking down. Imagine that multiplied by 93 million. Because you're looking 93 million miles into space and you actually see the sun and you have a sense of the space between you and the sun. It just really gives you a sense of where you stand in the universe and how puny we are, but also how we're part of something grand and amazing and beautiful. For some of us, it's an addictive experience.
Now, you mentioned the next total solar eclipse will occur on August 21st, 2017. And it's the first, as you mentioned, in 99 years to cross the entire breadth of the continental United States. How wide is the path of totality? Did you say about 115 miles or does it vary?
It varies. So this one will only be 70 miles wide. The one in 1878 was about 115 miles wide.
And where will you watch it?
I will be in Wyoming. All of North America on August 21st will experience at least a partial eclipse, and in many areas, a very deep partial eclipse. To see the total eclipse, you have to be in that 70-mile-wide path, which goes from Oregon to South Carolina. I live in Colorado, so the closest place for me to go is Wyoming, and I will be in Jackson, Wyoming on that day.
Now, we've talked about a lot, and there's no way we can touch on everything that's in this book. It was so well written and so well researched, but is there anything that you'd like to add that we haven't covered?
I have been planning this book for 19 years. When I saw my first total eclipse in Aruba in 1998 and just was overwhelmed by the experience, I'm overwhelmed just as a human being, but as a science writer, I thought, I need to write a book about total eclipses. I wanted to write a book about eclipse chasers. But I knew back in 1998 that the time when Americans would care would be in the summer of 2017. So I put the project on hold for a while, and then I looked around for the right book to write. So I had looked around and looked around, and I'm so just grateful that I found this story of the 1878 eclipse. I had so much fun doing the archival research. I mean, it was a lot of work and a lot of time spent in dusty archives, just looking through old telegrams and scientific reports and diaries. But the people in 1878 that I wrote about, they had the same deeply human experience that I had in Aruba. I mean, when I read their diaries or the letters that they wrote to each other and they talk about, I mean, these scientists who were going west ostensibly to do science, but they would admit to each other they just wanted to experience another total eclipse because it's just such a magical experience. And I really felt like even though they lived in a time when their technology was completely different and their culture was so different and medical advances were not nearly where they are today, it was a whole different world that they lived in. But their experience of a total eclipse was exactly the same as it is today. And it just connected me with history. And I hope to do that with this book, too, that I actually do think that total eclipses are a wonderful way to connect us to history. Because even though so much has changed, that rare experience of standing in the shadow of the moon and looking at the sun's corona, you know, we can just think back on the people back in 1878 or 1900 or 1925 who had that same experience. And I also think about the future. Think about the people 100 years from now. Someone will be writing a book about the eclipse of 2017. And for them, it'll be the same experience. So it was just great fun to write the book. And I hope that people enjoy reading it.
That was David Barron, author of the book American Eclipse, which was published by LiveWrite. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or on iTunes. This interview was recorded in Kansas City at KCUR Studios. It was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers. Special thanks to KCUR engineer Steven Steigman. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.